Kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Weather Training teleclass. My name's Jane Barrett and it gives me huge pleasure as usual to once again introduce a Weather Training South Pacific teleclass lecture. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker today, who's from Auckland in the North Island of New Zealand, Dr. Sally Roberts. I've had the pleasure of working with Sally in recent months on the Health Quality and Safety Commission project, so I'm delighted that she's able to present for us today. Sally is a clinical microbiologist and infectious disease physician at Auckland City Hospital and is the clinical head of microbiology at Lab Plus, Auckland District Health Board. She's been on a number of New Zealand Ministry of Health working groups, which include those related to MRSA guidelines, antenatal HIV screening, pandemic influenza and TB working groups. But more recently, she's been working with the Health Quality and Safety Commission as the clinical lead for the infection prevention and control programs. Welcome, Sally, and thank you very much for agreeing to be a speaker for the Weather Training teleclass series.
Thank you, Jane. Welcome, everyone. I thought I would take the opportunity to talk around quality improvement and its relationship with infection prevention. Quality improvement in healthcare is a relatively new activity, and it's a very important one. If you move to my first slide, I really have just tried to list what I think are some of the aspects that we need to think about when we talk about quality in healthcare. There are many differing definitions. It depends what reference you look at, but there are some common themes. Safe care, and we can see that in infection prevention control, where we want someone to come in and have a surgical procedure and avoid getting a healthcare-associated infection as a complication of that procedure. Effective care is around providing a service based on evidence-based knowledge to those who will benefit from it the most, and refraining from providing that service to those who are not likely to benefit from it. Patient-centred care really is around providing care that's respectful of and responsive to individual patient preferences, their needs and values, and that they are fully informed around the decision-making involved in their care. And these are sorts of issues that we deal with in infection prevention and control regularly, particularly when we are talking to patients who are identified as being colonised or infected with MRSA or VRE. Timely access is, you know, reducing wait times. Sometimes harmful delays occur to those patients, and their care is impacted on. So in New Zealand, the government has had a key performance indicator based on being seen, assessed and transferred or discharged from the emergency department within a six-hour time frame to try and reduce the length of time it took for assessment. Equitable access to care is really providing care that doesn't vary in quality because of personal characteristics, so your ethnicity, your gender, your age don't impact on your ability to get the same care. And value for money is really around that we give the best quality care that we can afford. The cost of healthcare is getting greater and greater, and we have limited resource to put into it. So one of the ways we can get good value is by removing excess cost out of the system, and we often do that by clinical pathways. We'll just move on to the next slide. So quality improvement is really around system change to improve an outcome. It's not focused on individual activities, but activities related to a system, and the system might be a care pathway, that might be procedures that occur in theatre, that sort of thing. And it comes with a sort of a culture of safety with patient safety at the centre of it. And it's sort of a no blame, no shame, no name culture, where it really is an improving the system or the process rather than attributing blame when an error occurs. One of the important components of it is transparency of reporting, and this can be just at a particular organisational level, so you might decide to report on healthcare-associated bloodstream infections in your organisation and show improvement over time with different activities. Or it may be that at a country level, you're required to report nationally on a particular event. And one of the important things about quality improvement is that we provide quality toolkits to enable healthcare workers really to do quality improvement. And this is around coming up with tools to help with data collection and analysis, evaluation, decision making, idea creation, analysis, and project implementation. These are, quality improvement activities are not something that are necessarily intuitive, and they do need some skills to deliver them. So the next slide just really is a cartoon illustrating the sort of no name, no blame, no shame culture. We don't really want, you want to do a root cause analysis around a significant event in the organisation. It really isn't about determining who was at fault. It's really around what system errors you can find and remove them so that you don't have to, the error won't occur because of them again. Or we'll put another way, do the right thing the right way the first time, every time. So quality improvement is really this gap between what we know and what we do. So we often know what we should be doing, but we don't do it. And one of the classics I hear is around hand hygiene, where you can educate people around what the five moments for hand hygiene are, but when you go out and observe what they do, they really have not applied that knowledge that they have. So we need to sort of get systems in place that make it easy for them to do it. Now, improvement always requires change, and I put in a small S there because it's often changes, it's not a single change. It's very difficult to go make a very large change. You have to do multiple small changes along the way to bring out change, and within each sort of change step you do, you're learning all the way along. Developing changes requires creative effort. So you need to be able to think outside the square, sort of avoid the same old approach that takes to every problem. Constantly hear, if you gave me more money, we could do this better, or we could do this, rather than looking at what the issue is and seeing how you can do it. We live in a very dynamic world, and we need to make change to keep pace, or that we don't need to make change for change's sake, but we do need to keep up. It's also around working with people. Some people are adverse to change. You need to get your team on board before you do start to do a quality improvement program, and it's very important to keep them well informed along the way so they understand each step of what you're doing. It's equally important to celebrate success as you make progress along the way. And I cannot emphasise enough the importance of strong clinical leadership in bringing around change in a clinical setting. Leaders often understand the social impact of change. They'll understand the people that they're working with, and they make people part of the solution. They also tend to be able to connect with the strategic goals of the organisation and understand why these changes are important. On to the next slide. So the quality improvement process is really around addressing a number of questions, really. You want to decide what the issue is, plan and prioritise. And one of the best ways to do this is to say, what are we trying to achieve as a group? And work to develop what's called sort of an aim statement, where you want to be able to say, this is what we do. And in the process of developing your aim statement, you'll be able to really refine what your question is and what you're trying to do to improve it. I think it aids in selecting the team that you're going to have that you need. For example, when we've been working with the surgical site surveillance program in New Zealand, one of the things I've been realising within my own organisation is the many different disciplines that are involved in the delivery of a surgical procedure. So we're having to, as we try and answer, develop our aims and try to say what we're trying to achieve, we're actually expanding our group and getting a better understanding. Also, by the time you've spent some time discussing this, you will have reduced variation in the activities that will be going on with your improvement program, so you become far more focused. And it also helps to allow you to establish a time frame for how long it might take to get your program going. You then need to think about collecting and analysing data to further understand the problem. So with our National Surgical Site Surveillance Program at present, we're capturing some baseline data at present so we can understand what the issues are in New Zealand. This means that to be able to collect and analyse data, you need to know what your definitions are and have strategies so that the data that's collected can be comparable over time. As you progress, you move on to testing and deploying. So once you've got your data and you know what the problem is and you've decided what the measure can be for improvement, you need to start with a smaller sample size and then progressively become larger as you become more confident with what you're doing. And it's very important to report your progress along the way and make adjustments. Sometimes it's difficult in New Zealand to get internal benchmarks to report against, and it's often when you look at external ones, the definitions used or the actual structure of the health system is such that it's quite different and it's hard to compare. But as you do compare, either with someone locally or you sort of feel confident comparing internationally, you can make adjustments to the program as you move closer to your desired goal, and that might be getting surgical site inspections down to the lowest acceptable level. So the next few slides I want to talk around really are around quality improvement strategies or methods, and I think the more exposure we have to quality improvement in infection prevention control, the more you need to understand these. When I was first starting working in this field, it was all a bit of a mystery to me and I didn't quite understand what they were about. So the first one is really what's termed the model for improvement. Now, this is a method that's used by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in the US, but it comes from probably the leading experts in sort of quality improvement, and that sort of has Dr. Schuhart and Dr. Deming have done a lot of work in the commercial sector establishing how to do improvement. And it's from their Plan, Do, Study Acts that a lot of additional other work's been built on. So with this model for improvement, you work your way through planning the changes and test, and then you do it, carry it out. You can study and summarise what happened and then act to make changes as they are. And these can be tiny little Plan, Do, Study Acts. It might be that you want to see whether a form you're developing works in the clinical setting, and you just go and try it on that one patient and come back and see what's happened and make adjustments. And that's certainly how we worked at Auckland District Health Board with the Central Line Associated Bacteremia Collaborative we were involved in. The next sort of strategy is called Six Sigma, and it's developed by Motorola and General Electric to improve process and eliminate defects in their performance. It really aims to reduce variation and achieve stable and predictable process results, and you can see on the little diagram I've given you there, it has a sort of define what the problem is, measure it, analyse the outcome from your measurements, improve the design, and then control from there, or it's sort of termed the DMAIC, D-M-A-I-C model. Lean process is really pioneered by the Toyota people, and it really is changing operational processes to become faster and more flexible and to reduce waste. You tend to hear Lean Six Sigma rolled together as one sort of improvement strategy now. And they have a very similar approach with define, measure, analyse, improve, and control. In our organisation, to improve communication around some particular key performance areas, we use the balanced scorecard, and it's not uncommon for me to have to go into a meeting at the boardroom and see these plastered around the walls, and each particular area is divided up, and then there's particular components within it. and you can see safety, quality, productivity, human development, cost, and implementation, and really then coming down the sort of y-axis are a number of sort of activities around what the metric is, what you're going to measure, what the top problems are, what the problem-solving solutions you might have, and what support you have for making change. So these are the ones that in health you'll be hearing used and need to get some sort of understanding of what they mean. But they're not difficult once you understand them, and they can be somewhat intuitive in their approach. Next slide. So we know that quality improvement and infection prevention and control go hand in hand. The sort of Senex study from the 1970s showed that the incident rate of nosocomial infections decreased and remained lower in hospitals that conducted surveillance for nosocomial infections. And that if you used evidence-based infection prevention patient activities, this continued to keep that rate low. We know that healthcare-associated infections are considered an important measure of quality. The Ministry of Health in New Zealand is developing or is asking district health boards to develop some quality accounts, which they will produce yearly, that talk around what activities they are doing to improve quality of care by their service. And a number of individual district health boards will have some key performance indicators that are infection prevention control activities. So at my district health board, we report on overall healthcare-associated bloodstream infection rate. We report on central line bloodstream infection events in our three intensive care units. We report on methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, vancomycin-resistant enterococci, and the ESBL-producing enterobacteriaceae on regular reporting schedule. We are looking critically at these, as we're not sure that some of them are particularly good measures of quality of care, and we'll probably make some changes in the next year or so. There's also evidence-based standards to reduce infection risk. You don't have to search too far to find best practice guidelines for central line-associated bacteremia or for preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections or for preventing ventilator-associated pneumonia. But while that information is known and the grade of quality of it is known, compliance with best practice is variable. I'll just move on to the next slide. So when we look at infection prevention activities, we really want to ask some questions. So what are we trying to achieve? We're really trying to reduce harm to our patients by reducing healthcare-associated infections. We want to get the rate down. I'm not sure that we'll get it to zero, but as close as to zero as possible. So if we're going to start doing some improvement activities, how will we know that the change that we're doing will be an improvement? We have to measure our change, and by this I mean we have to find some part of the process that we can measure. And I'm going to use the three national programs shortly as an illustration of this. We then want to know what changes can we make that will result in an improvement. And by doing this, if we improve our process, we want to make sure we improve our outcome measure. Now, outcome measure is usually our rate of infection, healthcare-associated infections that we get. So there'd be no point investing a lot of energy into developing a central line bloodstream prevention program if you didn't measure the outcome and show that the activities that you did actually benefited patients. Next slide. So when we look at the evidence around preventing healthcare-associated infections, it tends to focus on a procedure or a device-related intervention. And these, or device-related infection, I mean, and there are a number of interventions associated with reduced infection rates in this setting. The evidence for the effectiveness of them is variable. It might come from a randomized controlled trial, might come from an observational study, or pre- and post-interventional studies, or its expert opinion. I think it's important when you are putting some interventions into a bundle that you understand the strengths of each intervention. There's been quite a number of studies looking at ventilator-associated pneumonia, and they've used quite an assortment of interventions, and not all of them have good evidence supporting the reduction in infection with them. To make the bundles work, you need teamwork. It's not something that you can just say to a service and expect it to happen. You need to be working with them and alongside them. And working with them on these improvement cycles just around the delivery of them. And as I've said before, it's important that we work on measuring change. Next slide. So what are performance measures? Well, monitoring the performance is critical for assuring the effectiveness of a quality improvement intervention. So there's really two ways that I look at it. Performance can be measured by a process measure. So a process is the sort of pathway that a patient takes from getting on the theatre list into the theatre for their operation and during the operation and back out of it. Or it might be the process of inserting a urinary catheter or a central line. Within that process, you can break it down into a number of components. And some of those components will be quite simple and can be measured. Outcome measure looks at the outcome you're after. So if you want to reduce the rate of catheter-associated urinary tract infections, that the rate of those infections will be your outcome measure. So a quality indicator is the process measure and the outcome measure. Now, the New Zealand Health Quality and Safety Commission has developed some quality and safety markers, which are really quality indicators to assist district health boards with showing improvement in a number of areas, particularly falls, and they're also with some healthcare-associated infections. And we're going to cover these indicators as we move through our program. Next slide. So quality indicators need to have clearly defined numerators and denominators. So you need to know what you're measuring. You need to, so for an outcome measure, you'd want to know the number of procedures that have been performed, and the numerator would be the number of patients that had that procedure that got an infection. For a process measure, it might be the number of time staff performed a particular activity over the number of time, while they're inserting a device, over the number of those devices that have been inserted. The variables are often easy to identify and collect, so you want to be able to capture information collected in routine clinical care. You don't want additional information to have to be collected. And you want a data collection method that's sensitive enough to capture the data but can be standardised across a number of healthcare settings. One of the areas that we worked on was the central line, the bacteremia prevention program here, was how we captured the line days in the absence of a electronic system for doing that. And the three intensive care units worked on a number of processes, and eventually you will agree which one was the better one to do. You want to select outcome measures that occur frequently enough to provide an adequate sample size. So if the event is a very rare event, you're not going to get enough of them to be able to show change with time. And you want to compare populations with similar intrinsic risks or provide a means of risk adjustment, and that's done with the surgical site infection surveillance program, where we're doing some risk adjustments based on the National Healthcare Safety Network risk stratification process. Let's move on to the next slide. So the process measure, you can aim for 100% adherence to a recommended practice. And, you know, this is what we do with hand hygiene and what we do with the insertion bundle for the central line insertion process. You don't need to adjust for patients' underlying risk of infection or for their severity of disease at all. So when you were looking at what the process, it's often easy to pick a measure that you can capture quite quickly with minimal hassle, really. So outcome measure, you want at least one of them, and sometimes that's all you can get. You know, when we were working on developing the quality and safety measures with the Health Quality and Safety Commission, someone had suggested we catch 30-day mortality associated with some of these events, which is in fact a very difficult thing to do, so we luckily haven't chosen to do that. These outcome measures show that your changes to the process or the system are working. And they're a measure of harm, so you might catch a surgical site infection rate or a Staph aureus bacteremia bloodstream infection rate or new cases of colonisation with a healthcare pathogen, that sort of thing. The next slide. So I'm now going to move and talk about the New Zealand Health Quality and Safety Commission's infection prevention and control projects and just go slowly through these processes, projects, talking around the improvement methodology that they are using and what their measures are with this. So the first one is called Target CLAB Zero. It's a central line associated bacteremia prevention program. The next slide. It's a national collaborative to reduce central line associated bacteremia, and it's a collaboration between the Commission, a district health board, Counties Manukau, and Ko'aotea, which is an institute of improvement in health and connected with Counties Manukau District Health Board. Now, they use the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Model for Improvement approach using the collaborative methodology, and I'll come and talk to you about this shortly. This collaborative was very successful and it has engaged all the 20 District Health Board intensive care units across New Zealand. The model for improvement really asks three fundamental questions. What are we trying to accomplish, or what is the aim? And the aim for the Target CLAB Zero program was to reduce the central line associated bloodstream infection rate in intensive cares to less than 1 per 1,000 line days. How will we know that a change is an improvement? Well, they put in place some measures, and the measures they put in place are the compliance with an insertion bundle, compliance with a maintenance bundle, and their outcome measure is the central line associated bloodstream infection rate per 1,000 line days. Now, what changes can we make that will result in improvement? So there were quite a number of changes that were established during this program. They looked at establishing a single pack that had all the equipment that was needed in it for central line insertion. This pack allowed people to do the right thing. As you unwrapped it, there were the gloves there, then the hats and the gowns and the various other equipment that you needed to ensure full barrier precautions along the way. This pack's been continually refined as it felt the drape wasn't large enough, and with refinement and ordering of it, there's been some cost savings for the organisation. We'll just move on to the next slide. So this is what the IHI Breakthrough Series looks like. You select a topic and develop your mission statement about that you wish to reduce central line associated bloodstream infections to less than 1 per 1,000 line days. If there's not a lot known about the topic, you get a group of experts together and thrash out what interventions are known to improve it or what strategies you should apply. And from that expert group, you select what you call your faculty, who will then work with the participants, these are teams that want to be involved and improve this quality improvement initiative, and start the process there. And the groups come together and they hear about it, the first learning session, LS1, they hear about what the program's about, what the interventions are and what's going to be required of them. They return to their organisation and start the implementation phase and run their own little plan, do study X around how things will work in their organisation. And each organisation is different. They come together for a second learning session a number of months later to share where they're at and help solve some more problems. And then finally, go back and do some more PDSA cycles. And finally, at the third learning session, sort of celebrating success and working out how to sustain this program and to roll it out in other areas in their organisation. And so this started in, when was it, 18 months, October 2011, with the teams coming together, and it's been a successful collaborative. A number took some time to come on board, but it's done well. Oops, I used to know I've come the right way. So the measures in this program, the process measures, as I said earlier, are compliance with the insertion bundle and compliance with the maintenance bundle, and the outcome measure is listed there. Along the way, and I'm just going to talk around my own district health board because that's what I was involved in, but there's very similar activities were going on at the national level too. This insertion pack was created and really made making the right thing the easiest thing to do. This is an example of the insertion form at we created at Auckland District Health Board. And we have subsequently done a further couple of iterations since this one. I think we're up to our fourth version of it. And we make changes as we have experience with using it, and people provide us with some interesting insight on what would make the form better. And as we rolled it out across our organisation and different people come on board, they have some of them have different expectations for what we can collect, and the people who place peripherally inserted central lines in our organisation felt they'd like to be able to record the length of the PIC line each day, so we've incorporated that. This gets completed at the time of insertion and then signed by the proceduralist and the observer. And if all the activities are done, then it gets considered 100% compliant. On the other side of this form and on continuation sheets, we have information around the maintenance of the central line each day. Is it removed? Is it in use still? Can it be removed? Is there any sign of inflammation? Is there a single line used for TPN, etc.? That's not so easy to capture that information, and we're still looking at that. One of the things that was apparent in our intensive care units is our collection of blood cultures in septic patients was somewhat haphazard. So we have developed a strategy around the collection of two sets of blood cultures for each septic episode, and that there's no need to collect more than two sets in a 12-hour period. Each month we measure their practices and provide feedback. So two of the units now sit at about 88 to 90% compliance with the two sets, and the other units working hard to get there. The benefit of doing this is when you get a single set growing what could be a contaminant organism in some of the central line, it becomes a challenge to work out whether it's a central line bloodstream infection or not. And we've also, probably more at a national level than a local level, worked hard on how to apply the CLAB definition so that the reporting of events is consistent nationally. Next slide. So if we look at improvement over time, here's the process measures. The top graph looks at the national rate of insertion compliance, and it seems to sit around about 80%. The reason it's sitting around 80% is really to do with the rate that was in the pack not being quite long enough, and now that this has been corrected, that should improve and get to be higher. And the compliance with the maintenance bundle, you can see it did a big dip in July of last year, and that was really some additional district health board coming on board with data and taking a while to establish their process around capturing of the maintenance bundle data. But it's now sitting around 70%. And the central line associated bloodstream infection rate per 1,000 days is now sitting below 1, and this is national rate for all I think there's 23 or 25 intensive care or high dependency units in the 20 district health boards throughout New Zealand. So it's been an outstanding success. Next slide. So I'm now going to move on and talk around the National Surgical Site Infection Surveillance Program, which is a relatively new initiative that has just really got started at the end of last year. So the next slide. It's a collaboration between the Commission, Auckland and Canterbury District Health Boards, Auckland's in the North Island, Canterbury's in the South Island of New Zealand. This program has been quite a number of years in coming. A set of recommendations were developed in about 2009 around the need for one nationally, and really funding has really only just come through recently. So the similar approach to other international programs overseas, with the use of the US National Healthcare Safety Network definition, and we're doing 30-day and 90-day follow-up. We're currently not planning to do post-discharge follow-up until such a stage that we can standardise that collection nationally. And we're starting with orthopaedic leaders looking at total hip joint and total knee joint replacements. Next slide. So the improvement methodology here is really around Lean Six Sigma. So that's the DMAIC model that I talked about earlier, but as you can see, they are very similar. The program's really based on developing a robust and detailed delivery framework, which is using those definitions, following sort of international guidelines. We're working hard to get clinical engagement. We have established a surveillance system with web-based entry to capture the information and hope at time for it to become electronically captured. And it's a continuous improvement program. So just the next slide talks a little bit about the Lean Six Sigma or DMAIC approach. It really is to define the objective scope, goals and performance targets for your program, similar to what the aim or what your mission statement is with the model for improvement. Measure, so you measure the extent of the problem and get some baseline data, which in the process of doing now. Look at that data, see if there's any common trends, and then determine where improvement activities can best be made. We know there's some quite very good information on what activities reduce surgical site infections, so they'll be the ones that we target first of all, looking at antibiotic prophylaxis, surgical site skin antisepsis. And then once you get this process monitoring and continuous improvement go, we want to reduce the variability that we've been seeing and increase patient safety and effectively reduce harm. So you can see there's some similar themes for them. Traditionally in infection prevention control, we've been very good at measuring and analysing, but we haven't gone on to do the improvement component of it, and that's where these programs are very important. When we're looking at the measures for it, it's a bit of a work in progress at present because we're going to use the baseline data to help ensure that we can actually capture the information we need to measure changes in process. But we'll be focusing on antibiotic prophylaxis and skin antisepsis. And the outcome measures, just really in-hospital surgical site infection per 100 procedures, and this is either in hospital during that first admission or they're readmitted within 30 or 90 days with an infection. Oops, so I just go back one. So hand hygiene, we'll move on now to Hand Hygiene New Zealand. This is a program that's a collaboration between the Commission and Auckland District Health Board. It's really started in about 2008, but languished for a couple of years as there was a transition from one from the Ministry of Health to the Commission. But there's been really re-engagement of the sector with this program since June 2011. I can't give you the name of the improvement program related directly to hand hygiene. It's very different to the other programs that were either focused in an intensive care or on a particular surgical procedure. This is a multimodal culture change program delivered across the entire sector. And as a consequence, it has difficulties. So the next slide, the improvement methodology is is based on the WHO program. It's around making it easy to do the right thing by putting the product in an easy accessible place, providing audit and feedback. So once again, the measure is very important. A lot of education and champion and clinical leadership, really leading from the top down through the organisation, is very important. The next slide looks at the measures. So the measures haven't been too difficult, but their compliance with hand hygiene, and the outcome measure is healthcare-associated staph aureus bacteremia rate. I've written per 1,000, but it's actually per 100 inpatient days. So just moving on to the next slide. In summary, I think that the uniform implementation of infection surveillance, control and prevention recommendations will lead to improvements in our infection rates and patient safety programs. We need to blend the quality improvement activities in with our infection prevention and control program. So quality improvement and infection prevention initiatives really result in improved patient safety, and they're the important activities that we are focusing on. I just want to briefly mention, for the New Zealanders online, the Open for Better Care campaign. This is a national patient safety campaign that has been started by the Health Quality and Safety Commission. And it is going to focus on four key areas, of which healthcare-associated infections is one of these areas. It will be providing a lot of support for the sector, but also just raising awareness around these infections. And later this year, the surgical site infection surveillance will become the next activity that they're working on. So it's a different sort of phrase. It's an Open for Better Care. It's about, and when I first heard it, I thought this was very interesting. But when you think about it, we really want to be open to improve what we do, to ask patients what matters to them, work well in our team, and doing it right the first time. So if you don't know about this program, there's the website at the bottom. Get involved with the activities going on in your own district health board, which I think are very important. And it will also be an opportunity for us all to gain some additional expertise in this area. So in conclusion, I think the infection control has a key role to play in patient safety. Get involved in this patient safety campaign. Learn more about quality improvement in health and healthcare. It often sits within the quality department of your district health board, and if your infection prevention control sits in quality, you may get some exposure to it. If you sit within nursing or in other services, you may not. Later this year in September, the Asian Pacific Forum on Quality Improvement in Health and Healthcare is having a meeting in Auckland, and this is a very worthwhile meeting if you wish to get a better understanding about quality improvement in healthcare. And I will conclude there. Jane, do you wish to
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sally. I think you've really successfully highlighted today the obvious link and connection between infection prevention and control and patient safety, and obviously in particular the prevention aspect. So thank you very much for that. As well as participating in national programs like some of those that you've outlined here in New Zealand, do you think that IPNC teams utilise things like root cause analysis process enough for particular events, e.g., you know, the SSI events or bloodstream infections? Is that part of, is that a strong enough part of what we do, do you think?
I think there is room for doing that more often, but we have to make the root cause analysis a easy-to-do process, isn't it, that easily identifies what the key system zero is. And I think that would be a great way. We've certainly used that with the CLAB project at Auckland, where we, each time there was a central line bloodstream infection in one of the intensive care units, we'd made out this little form, which we quickly filled in, and then discussed it at our weekly meetings on what we thought might have contributed to that event occurring. And we've sort of determined from this who we consider high-risk patients are for getting central line infections, and now do additional measures with them, the use of chlorhexidine impregnated dressings to try and reduce their risk. And I found it very useful. The first three patients in one of the units had all been called for either neuroprotective or cardioprotective reasons and went on to get central line associated bloodstream infections quite quickly in their stay.
So make
the form simple and be in a system where you can discuss it every week.
And have those really strong linkages as well with the quality teams in our organisations. Some of us are better at in some areas than others. So because that linkage is so obvious, it's something that probably we just need to focus on and use these programs perhaps as a way of doing that.
Yes, I think so. And getting those skills and links is very important.
Mm. That's fantastic. Thank you once again, Sally. If anyone listening in today has questions for Sally, I'm very happy to forward them on to her. You can just use my weather training email address, which is on your slide, and I'll make sure that those will get passed on. So in closing, I'd like to thank Sally once again for her thought-provoking contribution to this year's telecast series. Quality and safety really should be at the forefront of everything we do in infection prevention. Thank you, the audience, for listening in, and don't forget that you can access any of the other weather training telecasts by registering via the website and listening to them live or on rebroadcast. Some of those telecasts that are coming up very soon are on, as Sally says, on that last slide of your presentation today. The next telecast in the South Pacific series will be broadcast live in August from the College of Infection Prevention and Control College conference, which this year is going to be held in Palmerston North in New Zealand. So I hope you'll be able to consider joining us for that. But until then, thank you very much and goodbye for now.